and our next guest knows a lot that he can't tell us. Until last year, he was the head of the United Kingdom's Secret Intelligence Service, known as MI6, basically the CIA of the UK. Sir John Sars is now chairman of Macro Advisory Partners, a consultancy advising companies and governments on geopolitical strategy. He joins us from London to talk about the things he can tell us, including terrorism, intelligence gathering, and privacy. Sir John, welcome. And let's start with, how do most of today's terrorists get radicalized?
Well, I think there are a number of routes to that. Certainly a big concern of us here in the UK are young people going out to places like Syria, joining what they might see as a uprising against a tyrannical regime, but falling in with a terrorist organization, going along with their extremist narrative and being sent back to the UK or to other European countries to commit terrorist attacks. Now, that is the biggest risk, I think, that we face. Obviously, you get some homegrown terrorists, people who become self-radicalized through what they read on the internet or what they watch on YouTube. But I think the biggest problem is this link between communities here in Europe and in the UK, and extremist organizations in places like Syria.
And what makes them do that, though, go to Syria in the first place? That seems like an extreme thing to do, given what's going on in Syria right now.
Yeah, well, I agree. And I think there's a lot of naivety amongst some of these people. Idealism and naivety tend to go sort of hand in hand. There's also some well-organized groups that encourage people to go, channel young, impressionable people who may be showing signs of frustration that they can't get a job or that they have split identities. They may have gone to school in the UK but have an origin, say, in Pakistan, and find that they don't have a clear identity. And what fundamentalist religion can do is give people an identity that they otherwise lack. And I think some of these terrorist organizers, they build on that and exploit it.
So when you hear people, and we've heard officials in this country, in the United States, say that one of the things that needs to be done is to improve the standard of living for people in these communities, in the UK, in Europe, in the United States, make sure that they're not down and out and looking for a home, something to call home. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm not sure it's the economic aspects that are the biggest driver here. I remember talking to a counterpart in Saudi Arabia saying that of the hundreds of young extremists that they'd had to arrest because of their involvement with terrorism or terrorist organizations, over 90% of them came from good families, were going to good universities, or were in good jobs. It wasn't a problem driven and created by impoverishment or unemployment. I think it's more a question of how much people feel that they have a stake in their society, a professional role, some satisfaction, and a sense of belonging in the community in which they're a part. And frankly, I think some of us in Europe have done less well on this than you in the United States have done. We do have large immigrant communities here. Some of them have integrated well. The Jewish community integrated very well 100 years ago. We've had Indian communities and others who have integrated well. But the Muslim community tends not to be as straightforward to assimilate into our society. And I think that's a big part of the problem.
And as you look at all of the migrants who are coming from places like Syria right now into Europe, are you worried that one of them is going to turn into a security threat?
Well, there's that possibility. I think the overwhelming majority of these refugees coming to Europe are genuinely fleeing the horrors of civil war and the bombings that are being inflicted on them by the Assad regime. They're being driven from their homes, and they're genuinely seeking a new life. Now, is it possible that one or two of them may turn to extremist organizations? Well, you can't rule that out. But I don't think there are cells in there that have been deliberately planted. I can't be sure, but I don't think there are. In many ways, the biggest problem comes years down the road, where when these new families settle in their new countries, their new homes, and it's the second generation, and sometimes even the third generation, which have real dilemmas and real tensions as to where they belong and where their allegiances lie.
And how do you explain that?
That is a longer-term problem. Well, I think it's because, as I say, Islam is a religion with a very strong culture, very strong rules, very strong behavioral guidance, and it's at odds with some of the freedoms that we have in Western societies. And I think that is that does cause young Muslims in particular, real stresses.
So, John Sarge, you have been posted in your career in places like Yemen, in Syria. You've spent some time there. When you hear people say, we've got to fight the terrorists over there so that they don't fight us over here, is that true? Do you think that the U.S., that the U.K. have to have boots on the ground, have to be bombing these countries, because if not, there will be a much bigger security threat in the homeland?
Well, we've learned from experience of the last 15 years that there are no easy choices in here. We here in Britain, alongside our American colleagues and many others, put troops on the ground in Iraq. We put troops on the ground in Afghanistan. And the results were not perfect. A lot of our people died. It cost an awful lot of money. And we didn't leave behind the stable societies that we were looking to do. But equally, when we don't intervene, as is the case in Syria, or when we only half intervene, as was the case in Libya, we intervened to overthrow the regime from the air, but we didn't put in troops on the ground to stabilize it, well, the situation can be even worse. Now, I don't think that Western military intervention is going to solve these problems. I think we have to take a longer-term approach to it. There's a huge humanitarian crisis that we have to deal with on the ground, but ultimately, there's going to have to be a political initiative that resolves these conflicts. I welcome the first signs in Yemen that the parties are committed to getting together and trying to find a negotiated solution. That's a good way forward. In Syria, I think that's still some way off because of the complications caused by the Russian intervention and by the very deep divisions in a society that's been racked by 4 years of civil war.
And still, you don't think that Western military intervention in Syria is the answer?
Well, I think it's important to keep that option open. Obviously, we've got the aerial attacks against Islamic State, ISIL, and I think they are having an effect in depleting the leadership of that organization. I'm not sure that's a complete solution. There was an opportunity over the last couple of years to consider safe areas on the ground or a no-fly zone to prevent the Assad regime using its air power. But frankly, that's all got much more complicated now the Russians are there on the ground. You can't really have a Western-imposed no-fly zone whilst the Russian Air Force are on the ground acting in support of the Assad regime. There are real risks in there that we have to avert.
I want to ask you about privacy and security. And ever since Edward Snowden's revelations about mass data collection in the U.S., there is renewed skepticism here about that kind of intelligence gathering. The U.K. has its own bulk collection and surveillance capabilities, but there seems to be less outrage there than here, and maybe even more of a culture where people accept being filmed wherever they go and more spying being done on the domestic population. What do you think is the right balance between security and privacy?
Well, first of all, I think every country is different on this. We all have our own histories. I don't think you can say exactly where the line of privacy and security comes. One thing, no society can have 100% privacy. Because if you have 100% privacy with no power of intrusion at all, then it empowers all the people who want to do evil, whether it's paedophiles or criminals or terrorists. Equally, you can't have 100% security. You can't have a society that is completely controlled and excludes all possibility of people letting off a bomb or carrying out a crime. So what our politicians have to do is find a way of both maximizing privacy and maximizing security, maximizing the two together. Obviously, this is becoming more difficult with new technology. We have to adapt it to new technology, but I don't think the fundamental principles change.
One more question, Sir John Sarge, which is what keeps you up at night?
Well, when I was chief of MI6, it was the prospect of one of the very risky operations that we carried out week in, week out going wrong, and my operatives paying the price for that. That was something that kept me awake then. And likewise, a failure of intelligence that led to innocent people being killed in the streets of Britain. I think now I have a sort of longer term concerns. They're not so much ones that keep me awake at night, but I do worry about our ability to manage Russia as it declines as a great power, but nonetheless is still bristling with modern armaments and has a leader in President Putin who easily takes offence and who wants to be treated as a great power in the world. I think that's a challenge. And I think the other big challenge that we're facing in the world is how we exist with two great powers, United States and China, alongside one another in a world where previously there's really been one major power. In the 19th century, it was Britain. In the 20th century, it's the United States. 21st century, we're going to have to get used to it being two powers, America and China. Mm. And we've got to find a way for them to coexist without war, without conflict, but without having to compromise the values of certainly of our side in that process.
That's Sir John Sars, who stepped down as head of the UK's secret intelligence service, MI6, last year. He's now the chairman of Macro Advisory Partners. Sir John Sars, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.